Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Young Andrew Bacevich felt a vocation to be a soldier. He left home in Normal, Illinois, for West Point and battle in Vietnam, then the first Gulf War. He is rueful now about American wars in his long lifetime, and he's answering a second vocation to write what he's learned about misplaced faith and force and where it has taken his country. His eighth book on military and foreign policy, just out, is titled The Age of Illusions: How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. When we got a chance to talk about it in the Cambridge Forum, the usual book and author interview sounded at moments like two old Catholic altar boys lapsing in their 70s into musing what became of the USA that was the toast of the world in their boyhood after World War II. Andrew Bacevich opened his talk as an historian with his own big picture of 30 years since the fall of the Berlin Wall and the end of the Soviet Union.
So the book came out a week ago today, and from one point of view, it's an explanation of how we got Trump. From another point of view, it's a history, a concise narrative of the post-Cold War era. That's a phrase, post-Cold War era, that recurs throughout the book, referring to the roughly quarter-century-long interval between the fall of the Berlin Wall in October 1989 and the election of November 2016. Now, we know the several decades that came beforehand as the Cold War. The period that began with the election of Donald Trump has not yet acquired an agreed-upon name, although I am confident that it will not be called the Age of Trump. But my focus in this book is on what came between, the sequence of events that took the nation from a moment of ostensibly unprecedented triumph, when the future seemed ours to define, to a moment when a profoundly divided electorate installed as president someone manifestly ill-equipped for the office. The overarching theme of that story is hubris. What happens when an arrogant policy elite suddenly fancies itself relieved of constraints and called upon to define the future of humankind? That describes the immediate response to the fall of the Berlin Wall. And with perfect timing, the scholar Francis Fukuyama captured the mood of the moment in 1989 when he published an essay called The End of History. Now, the editor of the journal in which the essay appeared inserted a question mark after history, as if Fukuyama were posing a question. In fact, an exclamation point would have been more appropriate, as members of the policy world quickly leaped to the conclusion that the end of the Cold War signified something very profound indeed. The field was now wide open for the United States to define the history that was to follow the end of history, so they believed. America had won the Cold War, and the United States would now determine what was to come next, not only for Americans, but for the planet as a whole. Note the dubious and indeed dangerous assumptions embedded in those last two sentences. One is the notion that the Cold War itself defined the essence of global history in the latter half of the 20th century, with all other matters relegated to the status of afterthought. A second was that we had won. triumphed, prevailed, vanquished the adversary, and were therefore in a position to reap the rewards. With the benefit of hindsight, I've come to believe that the Cold War was not a contest to be won so much as to be endured. It was a vast and arguably unnecessary tragedy which the United States managed to survive. The proper response to the end of the Cold War was not celebration, but repentance. But that is not the interpretation that prevailed after the Berlin Wall went down. Now, let us acknowledge that Americans have an affinity for hubris that predates the passing of the Cold War by several centuries. The conviction that it is incumbent upon America to determine the course of history has a long pedigree. We can trace its origins at least as far back as John Winthrop's famous Sermon of 1630, when he charged his doughty band of followers with establishing a city upon a hill destined to illuminate the entire globe. Well, that claim came roaring back after 1989, when it appeared that no obstacles remained to prevent the United States from completing its providentially assigned saving mission. Pursuant to that mission, four big ideas emerged to form the basis of U.S. policy in the wake of the Cold War. And at the risk of spoiling the story for you, those ideas were, first, a belief in the capacity of corporate capitalism operating on a global scale to create unprecedented wealth in which all would share. The one-word name for this was globalization. Second, a belief in American military supremacy, thought to be beyond challenge, to serve as an instrument enabling the so-called indispensable nation to keep order and spread American values. Third, a belief in a radically expanded conception of individual freedom unmoored from traditional norms. This new definition of freedom was heavy on rights and privileges, and notably light on duties and obligations. Fourth, a belief that history had charged the President of the United States with serving as the great helmsman who would preside over all that was to come next, with the White House now GHQ of the entire universe. All four of these ideas were laced with faith in the transformative effects of information technology. God might be dead, but we had Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, and Google et al. To fill the void left by his departure. It fell to the three presidents of the post-Cold War era, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama, to translate these ideas into actual policy. I do not mean that those three presidents subscribed to an identical worldview. I do mean that all three found themselves called upon to fulfill a set of expectations that policy intellectuals had foisted upon an unsuspecting public. With what results? Well, I don't want to give away the punchline, but let me just say that we ought to see the election of 2016 as a referendum on that post-Cold War agenda. In sufficient numbers to install Donald Trump in the White House, voters, their numbers effectively augmented by citizens who couldn't even be bothered to vote, they said no to the economic disparities stemming from globalization. They said no to the endless wars resulting from the misuse of American military power and the abuse of American soldiers. And they said no to the alienation and enemy that were byproducts of discarding traditional moral norms. So they handed power to a mountebank who promised to make America great again. We can argue about the myriad factors contributing to Hillary Clinton's defeat, to include her own failings. But the outcome of the election represented a decisive repudiation of the core elements comprising the post-Cold War consensus. The anger expressed daily by columnists in the New York Times or hosts on MSNBC and CNN testifies to a continuing refusal to acknowledge that repudiation. Trump's election instantly plunged the United States into a political crisis that will not end until he leaves office. Indeed, my expectation is that the crisis will persist after he departs office, simply because few members of our political establishment are willing to own up to why he became president in the first place. In other words, Trump is not cause, but consequence of that crisis. He won because a set of propositions expected to define history after the end of history failed egregiously. And the beginning of wisdom, in my estimation, lies in facing up to that central truth. Only then will it be possible to take on the difficult task of healing our divisions and charting a path forward, a path based on reality rather than on a fanciful misreading of history's actual intentions, which will remain hidden, as always. Thank you very much.
Coming up, a vision of the world that got coded into a famous book title, The End of History. Then it morphed into a strategic agenda, then a mindset, until it stumbled before our eyes. This is Open Source. We're at the First Church in Harvard Square, Cambridge, and the soldier citizen Andrew Bacevich is speaking his book. It's one man's 30-year history of what followed the Cold War. First, a theory that history itself was over, and the U.S. won it. Then a strategic agenda that became a mindset till reality started to crack it. I asked him to explain, as if to his grandchildren, what happened.
I certainly believe that the Cold War defined contemporary history. The two phrases were interchangeable. Cold War, history. And therefore, as a young man growing up, I was oblivious to any number of other vectors of change that deserved far more attention than they deserved. I'll give you one very specific example that we are now all aware of, and that is the expectation that there was no end to the amount of punishment we could inflict upon nature pursuant to our desire to achieve a way of life rooted in material possessions and continuous personal mobility. Simply did not occur to me that there was a limit to the punishment that the planet could absorb. And I wouldn't think about that because, again, as far as I was concerned, history was defined by this face-off between the United States and the Soviets, the free world and the communist world, the godly people and the godless people. So I almost feel like I need to apologize to my grandchildren for having grown up and absorbing this incredibly distorted and narrowing vision of what contemporary history is all about. If you accepted that vision, therefore, you became susceptible to the triumphalism that marked the end of the Cold War. You know, the notion that we won, and that having won, we were in a position of dominion. And that if we had won, if we thereby demonstrated our superiority over the Soviet system, it followed that we possessed the wisdom now to act upon our victory in ways that were going to simply lead to other benefits for ourselves and for others. And this was a terrible, incorrect, utterly wrong perception, I now believe.
I wonder how you came to it, in the sense that this is the American exceptionalist view. You know, empires rise and fall, but the rules don't apply to us. How did that come to prevail in your important young head over everything else you knew, which was that this is my father's world, this is God's world, we are the infinite delight of our maker, but we're also flawed and in need of correction, and that we're not going to save this world, we need to be saved, etc. All of the religious values of restraint, humility, a deeper, more grown-up understanding. How did you or I...
I've never been asked these questions before, I have to tell you.
Wow, good.
I am a practicing Catholic. Growing up in the 1950s and the 1960s, from a Catholic perspective, the 50s are the time when we conclude that we are now fully accepted as members of America, of society. We have achieved equality. And this itself was cause for celebration. I still love to watch Going My Way with Bing Crosby. But I think that...
He worked our parish at Sacred Heart Church in Newton Center, Massachusetts. That was it.
That was its own version of triumphalism. And therefore made Catholics like me more willing to conform to the American project in its myriad manifestations, and less willing or less able to think critically about that project. Now, the fact that I went to West Point and became a professional soldier did not exactly encourage me to embark upon critical thinking. And I must say it was only after I left the Army, became a civilian, Cold War has now ended, I no longer exist in the womb of this all-encompassing institution as a member of the military profession, that at least it became possible for me to begin to think somewhat differently. And I think that's where recognizing the existence of this post-Cold War consensus that I've tried to describe and coming to see the deficiencies of that consensus, whether we're talking about political economy or military policy or culture, led me to begin to think much more critically about my own country than I had been able to do as a younger man. Perhaps because I had spent a considerable time as a soldier, I became preoccupied in particular with the misuse of American military power, the embarking upon misguided wars, the mismanagement of our wars, perhaps most of all, what I perceive to be the obliviousness of the American people to those wars. You know, here we're in 2020. The Afghanistan war began in 2001. It continues. We now know, thanks to the so-called Afghanistan papers that were published by the Washington Post, that we have been lied to about the supposed progress. We know that the people charged with managing the war knew that they didn't know what was going on. And what's striking to me, one striking thing to me, is the Afghanistan papers were a big story for what? 3 days? 4 days? But since then, we moved on.
I wonder. No, that to me, that goes into the sort of the riverbed of guilt and sadness and disillusionment that stays there for a very, very long time, and we don't know yet what it produces. I think it was part of what produced Trump. I don't want to sound like two old altar boys exactly, but I want to know who you blame for this. And if you don't want to say, I want to guess. But I also want to...
I don't want to say. You guess.
Well, no, but I mean, The only president in my time that you could really fall in love with was John Kennedy, and he started a war knowing absolutely that it was wrong. And it's in his diaries in the early 50s in Vietnam. Brother Robert, the same thing. This was a French colonial project, and we will get chased out of here. It's in their young handwriting, and yet they embarked on it. We killed 2 million Vietnamese people for what? So my great God is my great deceiver, great illusion. And then we got through the Fulbright hearings, a real kind of good confession of our failures. John Kerry, you know, who's going to be the last man to die for a mistake? Parenthetically, I can't resist this. John Kerry, against every kind of odds, becomes chairman, becomes a senator, chairman of that committee. Never held hearings on Iraq, for which he voted yes and voted no. I mean, something ghastly has happened to the public wheel in that short series of...
But your question began...
Dissolution.
Who do you blame?
Who do you blame?
So when I was a young apprentice historian, I have to say that I believed in the great man theory of history, that if you want to understand the trajectory of events, well, then you need to look at Lincoln. You need to look at Woodrow Wilson. You need to look at John F. Kennedy. I no longer buy that at all. Hmm. That brings me back to my theory of the post-Cold War era. The Iraq War of 2003... The decision to invade was an epic mistake for which we are still paying and peoples of the Middle East are still paying. We unleashed chaos. I don't blame George W. Bush for that.
Why not?
Because what I blame is the mindset that had come to exist by 2001 when 9/11 occurred, by the time we get to 2003. A mindset that said, we're strong. Nobody's as strong as we are. We're smart. Nobody's as smart as we are. We can fix this. American soldiers can fix this. Let's invade this country. Let's overthrow the Saddam Hussein regime, and we're going to fix things. Well, I mean, the arrogance, in retrospect, the arrogance is absolutely stupefying. And I think that in many respects, Bush, I would make the same point about Clinton before and Barack Obama after, were responding to the circumstances in which they found themselves. Yes, they wanted to maneuver. Obama, I think, is a very good example. Remember, he runs for the presidency, denounces the Iraq war as stupid, describes the Afghanistan war as necessary, vows that he will end the Afghanistan war, he'll win the Afghanistan war if elected, becomes president. And I think from the point of view of using force, his presidency is also a disaster. Not only because calling an end to the American war in Iraq allows forces of disorder in the form of ISIS to run amok, not only because his expectation of being able to surge U.S. forces in Afghanistan and that would bring order there, that was foolish. But even more so, remember, it was Obama who bought into the notion of overthrowing Colonel Gaddafi in Libya, after which Libya becomes chaos. It was Obama. You know, we are upset, we rightly upset, I am upset about the Soleimani assassination by the president, by this president. It was Obama who institutionalized the notion of assassinating people we don't like. Without right. anybody's authority. You're not checking with Congress first. You're right. killing people because you decide that they pose a problem to the United States of America. Why did he do that? I think because he was operating within this post-Cold War frame, which imposed on presidents these exaggerated expectations of what force, our force, can accomplish politically.
I think we go in the same general direction. The ones I blame are the ones that knew better. And I think Obama knew better. But what has most changed in this 50-year, roughly, period that we've been around thinking about it is there's something in the establishment values of this country, and they have lost, to my observation, every bit of sort of the moral authority that we used to count on. I mean, Father Hesburgh or Billy Graham or whatever your denomination, Martin Luther King, these were people of serious reflection, and you could sort of turn to them, agree or not. But the question, and I don't want to get too churchy at all either, but I mean, where is the compass that says, cool your jets, America, you're a blessed country, but that's about it in terms of your writ to beat up the world?
I mean, which individuals speak with that kind of moral
authority? Just thinking, it's hard to find a villain.
Why do we have to look for villains? Again, why
people to
why
hold responsible, to hold accountable, to say, in a simple, pragmatic review of the situation, that was a bad idea, or that was a bad leader, or that was a bad decision.
Well, don't confuse the two. I mean, in other words, let's be able to say, that was a bad idea. Let's not worry about, that's a bad person. Let's focus on the bad ideas.
I'm going the same way. But what is it in the consensus judgment of our country that has lost its standards, its spine, its articulation?
I don't know an acceptable answer.
Yeah, it's okay.
I mean, the burden of my, maybe a submerged theme of my book, the Cold War was a terrible period in world history. The Cold War caused us to do any number of stupid things. But in an odd sense, the Cold War served a useful purpose in curbing our most extreme tendencies as a people. Because we believed we had to focus on the main game. The main game was, how are you going to prevent the Soviets from invading Western Europe? How are you going to prevent World War III from happening? So we couldn't stray too far off the sensible course. Once the Cold War ended, those self-imposed constraints go away. And we think, we persuade ourselves. We, to me, our intellectual policy elites, persuade ourselves that we can do anything we darn well please, and we will achieve success. We will transform the world in our own image. I think you can make a strong case that the Americans have always wanted to transform the world in their own image. For a considerable period of time, we thought we would do that by providing an example for others to mirror. But after the Cold War, we're not talking about example. We're talking about shoving it down their throat, and do it in very forceful ways that elicited then enormous resentment on the part of Arabs, Iranians, Russians, Chinese, you know, you name it. So it is this enormous arrogance that was one of the preeminent qualities of the post-Cold War era that, it seems to me, led us down the wrong path. Again, I'm not blaming people. I'm looking at ideas and attitudes that shaped policies.
Something happened after the end of the Cold War. We didn't really extend much encouragement, embrace to the old enemy. And it's been sort of U.S. force projection ever since. And it's been one awful moral and political embarrassment after another. Worse than that. But serious. They joke about it in China. You talk democracy and your exhibits are Afghanistan, Libya, Iraq, this is a promise to the world. Why hasn't the world said to us more unmistakably, guys, you're way, way off the beam?
I suspect that behind closed doors, they are reaching that conclusion.
I'm sure they are.
You know, were I a senior political figure, let's say in Europe or in East Asia, wherever, I'd be gathering my advisors together, and I think the question I would ask is, okay, folks, is Trump an anomaly, and that his departure from the stage will result in a return to some version of normalcy? Or is Trump indicative of fundamental change in what makes the Americans tick? The anti-Trumpers, Democratic Party perhaps more broadly, genuinely believe, that with Trump out of the way, the status quo will be restored. I myself don't think that's true, because I think that the anger and alienation that gave us Trump are not going to be removed simply by removing Trump himself. We got a deeply divided country. It is not a divided country because Donald Trump is president. Donald Trump became president because we have a deeply divided country.
Meaning what? What is the axis of division? Is it has not? Is it red, blue, east, west?
All of the above. I may have my facts slightly wrong here, but I mean, we've got greater inequality, economic inequality, in our country today than either we ever have, or at least going back to the Gilded Age of the late 19th century.
But the disadvantaged in that gap are not going to find another Trump.
I'm not arguing that they're going to find another Trump. I'm going to argue that the anger, their anger that found expression in Trump being elected president is not going to dissipate just because Trump goes away. They're still going to believe that they are being screwed by an economic system that is fixed in the favor of other people. Similarly, I think there's an underappreciated anger among those who send their sons and daughters to serve in the military. I think there's underappreciated anger that they have in the way that American soldiers have been abused. And getting rid of Trump is not going to make them feel better. I think that there is, perhaps not as definitively articulated, I think that there is at least confusion about the consequences of abandoning traditional moral norms.
Mm-hmm.
And that simply getting rid of Trump is not going to clarify, it's not going to bring us cultural unity or moral clarity.
Coming up, American exceptionalism. Still waiting an actionable definition. Andrew Bacevich calls it our original sin. This is Open Source. Andrew Bacevich is a West Pointer, long retired from the military, recently retired from university teaching, not running for office. So he is free to speak his strong mind about what he's learned into his 70s. His new book is The Age of Illusions. He and I are in conversation at the Cambridge Forum in Harvard Square in January 2020.
My view is that we are stuck in a very profound crisis that gave us Trump, and that getting rid of Trump still is going to find us locked in this crisis. And I think what it comes down to in simple terms is that there exists no broadly accepted definition of the common good, a notion of the common good to which all Americans can subscribe, whether they call themselves conservatives or progressives or whatever. There was, indeed, during the Cold War, again, in an ironic sense, the definition of the common good was that we Americans all oppose communism. We Americans believe in freedom and they don't. Now, again, that also was not empirically true, but it was a substitute for truth and gave an answer to what it meant to be an American.
I want to disagree with you wholeheartedly. I don't think we're that divided a country. Of course, there's both sides of the tracks and there's rich and poor and whatnot. I think the country's basically moral orientation, social orientation, is fundamentally what it was.
So what's your explanation for how Donald Trump became president?
Well, it'd be a lot like yours. But the whole point is, this is going to sound like flattery, and I don't mean it that way. I think you are a magnificent embodiment, Andy, of what this country thinks it is and wants to be. Hardworking, regular people with all your life in one manner or another has been about the public space and world in this country, including its military forces. You're a family guy and a believer, which even the non-family, non-believers admire and recognize as stalwart citizen community values. And we love it. We like it. The question in my mind is why we sort of torture ourselves with our doubts about those fundamental qualities and why we don't see more of them in our public life. In other words, nobody wants to be Trump. Nobody likes Trump. The first program we ever did on Trump was realizing that everybody knew a guy like that in high school. The showboat, the millionaire's kid, big car, thought he was the great lady man. Obnoxious, faker, obvious through and through. I remember mine very vividly. We don't like those people. We like the guy who's working hard to do a job in the public interest. And we still do. I think Bernie would have beaten Donald Trump. I think almost anybody would have beaten Hillary Clinton. She was too long in the public realm without any significant clear objective achievement. But she also stood in for a line of Bushes and Bill Clinton who were pretty much the same thing, a sort of a failed generation of people who were not dealing with...
Well, I think this coming election will allow you to test your hypothesis. That is to say, I mean, there are Democrats who fit with your depiction of, you know, good, honest, decent, hard-working men and women. If one of them gets the nomination, and if that person then wins the presidency, we'll see if that heals our divisions. If we got Mayor Pete in the White House, will the Trump faction in our country rally around Mayor Pete?
No, they won't. I mean, I'm thinking Cory Booker was more to my taste than Mayor Pete, but people who will say, no, we're not going to send home your veterans either in a body bag or suicide or addicted or ruined, those are the communities that elected Donald Trump in a rage. These respectable establishment candidates had delivered them war after war after war for what?
I agree with that, that contributed to why he won, that there are many sources of anger that resulted in Trump's election, and one of them, I think, is anger related to our misguided military policy.
We haven't resolved any standard of when we intervene or when we don't, whether it's in Haiti or Libya or...
Somalia,
you name it. We could do something for the world if you could give us a kind of Basevich doctrine, well aware that we savaged Vietnam, we totally wrecked the country of Iraq. Our record is a miserable failure in my lifetime. And yet we are still the biggest guy around. What would your test be of a rational and even promising test of intervening in other people's...
Well, I think I would begin this way. So we posit a situation where doing nothing is unacceptable. I think I would begin the conversation by saying, well, what can we do that does not require us to use force? Because when we use force, our experience tells us, we let loose all kinds of unintended consequences. So are there ways to help, to provide aid and assistance that doesn't require dropping bombs on people? And I think that in many cases, the answer is yes. To put it as bluntly as possible, we are a big country. We are a rich country. Mm-hmm. We can accommodate people in this country that are being victimized. Now, politically, we don't want to accept these people in our country because many of them don't look like you and me. But that really gets to the point that the humanitarian instinct that so often leads to military action is about that deep, right? Mm-hmm. It'll make me feel good if we can do something for these people as long as it doesn't inconvenience me back here in the land of the free and the home of the brave. So again, the point is we feel compelled to act. Are there options available to do not begin with the use of military force? I would want people to answer that question before going any further.
I remember a guy who lives around here suggesting that the standard for intervening on behalf of an aggrieved nation or embattled nation might be ask what they're doing on their own to improve the next generation's water supply. In other words, we don't go in on oil cases, we don't go in on communist cases or how you run your economy, but there would be another test for me would be, do we go in with others?
Yeah,
no
sure.
More wars of choice, but wars of coalitions to do such things.
I think that would generally tend to be helpful.
So I'd like to open up the questions. I'm sure lots of you have questions, so please feel free to ask a single question at the microphone.
My question is, when Soleimani was murdered or assassinated, right away there were leaders of the Democratic Party who said, he's a murderer, he murdered at least 600 of our troops, et cetera, et cetera. And New York Times reporters, it's almost as if the editors insisted that phrase be dropped into every story. And at one point there was a reference to Petraeus, a truly honorable man who's never been convicted of anything. He was the source for this alleged fact of Soleimani being responsible for the murder of 600 American soldiers. Could you comment on that?
Well, I don't want to be a General Soleimani apologist. I mean, some of you know my son was killed in Iraq. But let's get serious here, okay? 9/11 happens. There are no Iranian hijackers out of the 19. President Bush and his administration decides that he's going to embark upon a great war in the Middle East. Primary target is Iraq. Expectation is if we get rid of Saddam, we're going to pacify Iraq and other good things will follow. In framing the war that is going to become, that is about to come, the administration declares that the larger target of this war is an axis of evil. Now that word axis, of course, is loaded. And we're hearkening back to the other time we went against the axis. And Iran is designated part of this axis of evil. They didn't participate in 9/11. Matter of fact, as the Americans were ginning up preparations to intervene in Afghanistan, there were talks, whether direct or indirect, with Iranian authorities asking if Iran would provide certain assistance in that campaign. I believe it related specifically to the recovery of any downed American aviators in the coming fight against Afghanistan. They signed up. So we then invade Iraq, a neighboring country to Iran. We occupy Iraq. We turn Iraq into a total mess. And Iran responds by trying to complicate that occupation, by trying to increase the penalty that the Americans are going to pay for their folly in invading Iran's neighbor and in blaming Iran somehow for 9/11. I think that, from the point of view of killing Americans, this is a terrible, terrible thing. I think it is utterly understandable on their part. I am not one of the people who mourns Soleimani's death. But we need to be serious about the politics that we have plunged into. And at this stage of the game, to somehow make the case that how terrible it is that innocent Americans have been killed is quite a whitewash and really is pretty contemptible.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Early in the conversation, you talked about hubris and your youth and why you didn't do better, why you didn't see what truly was going on. And you talked about how will I answer grandchildren if they ask me what I did? How will you coach grandchildren, help them to try to avoid getting caught in the same hubris and sucked in by the idea of American exceptionalism?
The truth is, I don't know. You know, I am of a mind that American exceptionalism is our original sin, that this deep-seated claim that we are the chosen people called upon to change the world and remake it in our image, this is an abiding theme. You might have thought that the debacle of Vietnam would have purged that inclination from our collective consciousness, but it did not. By the time Ronald Reagan became president, it was back. And as long as we continue to believe that, I think that we will continue to blunder, and we will be immune to learning. That's a pretty pessimistic statement, but I think it may well be true.
Thank you.
At the risk of being too churchy in the words of Mr. Leiden, and we have two former altar boys, I understand. I wanted to ask a theological question, not really, but it was made by a Catholic priest. He was a war resister. He was a poet. Daniel Berrigan once said, we have to sacrifice as much for peace as we would for war. And Professor Bacevich has made the observation that after the fall of the Berlin Wall, there should have been repentance, not celebration. Mm-hmm. So here in the bluest city, in the bluest state, so approximate to the incubator of our foreign military, political, legal establishments, what can we do individually to repent? And what can our country do collectively to repent? Thank you.
Go ahead, Chris.
You're asking me.
Well, he was asking both of us.
I don't know. We should pray more. We should be more reflective about our own private but public sins. We should remind ourselves every day of our place in the universe, and it's a blessed one, and it's also a humble one. I'm not a preacher. I am a believer, happily. But look in the mirror. I mean, we should be held accountable. My great model, and I think he means a great deal to Andy too, is William James. William James, who invented the idea of pragmatism, it's all tied up in accountability, reviewing what you've done as a nation, as a community, and sorting out the disasters from the successes, and making things that work. An idea is to be judged by its results. And if it keeps banging into military, moral, political, global disaster, we've got to question that idea. It's a deep question. Who calls not only sinners but destructive forces to account? We don't do it much anymore.
So when I was being raised as a young altar boy and being taught by the nuns...
As was I.
A lot of emphasis on the notion of vocation, positing that we each as individuals have a vocation, called upon to play a role. And the nuns basically said, hey, you need to think seriously to find what your vocation is so you can find your place, so you can make your contribution. Of course, that went right by me.
No, it didn't.
I think I wasted a considerable part of my life doing things that drew me away from my vocation. I think my vocation is to be a writer. Now, I have no expectation of changing the world in any significant way. But it seems to me that's where I can make some kind of a contribution. Other people have different vocations. I mean, they're called upon to, you know, to feed the hungry and shelter the homeless. They're called upon to take care of the sick. They're called upon to be cops and firefighters. Maybe they're called into business, but then they're called to be ethical in their behavior in business. So I have really come to the conclusion, and this is another one of my shortcomings as a young person, that deep and sustained reflection to identify one's own vocation is really, I think, a crucially important precondition to becoming a mature adult. Mm-hmm. It's not just sort of the first thing that appeals to you. Mm-hmm. If it would have been, then I would end up as a professional basketball player.
Thank you, Andy.
Andrew Bacevich's book is The Age of Illusions, How America Squandered Its Cold War Victory. Cambridge Forum Conversations are made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter and sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the Massachusetts Cultural Council, the Harvard Bookstore, and First Parish Church in Cambridge. Thanks also to Mary Stack and Annie Schreffler. Open Source is a proud affiliate of Hub and Spoke, a collective of energetic, idea-driven podcasts. This week on Soonish, Wade Rausch's show about our technological future, election dreams and nightmares. Look for it at soonishpodcast.org. Check out all of the Hub and Spoke shows at hubspokeaudio.org. And of course, check out all the open source shows at radioopensource.org. For our Patreon subscribers this week, producer Adam Coleman has a conversation with Miranda Popke around her new novel, Topics of Conversation. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. George Hicks is our audio engineer. Mary McGrath is our illusionist. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time for Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.